We now have time for some other questions. And the first one's from Ken Pratt. And this is a question on the US. Ken, where are you?
Over here. Yeah.
Go, Ken.
Go, Ken. Am I a Mexican?
This is you. Yeah, Ken gave us two questions. He's so keen.
But
sure. I'll read it out if you want, Ken.
Yeah, go and read it.
You sure you want me to read it out? So, in the face of hugely powerful corporate lobbying of the United States Congress, can accounting standards setters realistically expect to introduce standards that will result in lower reported profits and weaker balance sheets?
Well, here again, I think the answer lies in using the press. The classic example, share option accounting. The FASB tried to make people expense share options in the late 90s. They were beaten back with a ferocious lobby by the Financial Executives Institute, who spent about $70 million lobbying Congress, and eventually the SEC had to say to the FASB, back off. Mm-hmm. When you looked at what was happening, you started looking for support. Now, Warren Buffett was a supporter. George Bush was not. But the numbers, and when you started showing it to the press, the fact that if you charge these things, American profits would have dropped by about 29%. Mm-hmm. This is in 2001. You look to the top 500 American companies, they were spending, on average, $479 billion. These numbers are etched on me, you can see that. $479 billion per annum each, buying back shares to stop the dilution of these options. Mm-hmm. The options, while they said they went to employees, yeah, they did, except 75% of them went to the top five executives. Mm-hmm. So if you look at 479 million, you take three quarters of that and divide by five, that's about $72 million each per annum. And you wonder why we've got Enron mm-hmm. ramping the share prices? Mm-hmm. And Enron was just a couple of years after that. And that's the sort of thing mm-hmm. that happened. And the arguments they used was that, it's a shareholder transaction. It's nothing to do with the company. So if it shares, it doesn't count. So you think, well, what about consolidations then? Do they not count either? Mm-hmm. And or it's costless. It doesn't cost anybody anything. Well, give us all some. We'll all get rich. Mm-hmm. And or it will have unfortunate consequences. Yeah, and you're... pocket, that's what we'll have consequences on, because eventually the press got hold of this mm-hmm. and we put it through an IFRS and the Americans came in on our coattails mm-hmm. and stopped it. And Congress was almost powerless because mm-hmm. there was such an outcry in the Wall Street Journal and things like that. So again, I think it's trying to move the public mood in a certain direction, and it makes it hard for the politicians, even the politicians, to do something.
A somewhat related question from Tim Burrows. Do you want to ask it, Tim?
I've probably written it more eloquently than I could say it now. So
is it right that multinationals such as Google, Starbucks and Amazon can use their corporate structure to substantially reduce their tax bills?
Well, I think like everybody else, I don't like that one little bit. The fact is, when the business is here and they're built out of Ireland and the profits generated in Ireland with lower tax rates, mm-hmm. there's something phony about it. Mm-hmm. And I think the way it's going to have to be tackled, which they tried to at the G8, certainly, is either we sort of align tax rates so there's no great incentive, but companies are attractive to others because they get income from other ways, like income tax and so on and VAT, or you have to change the rules and base them on some sort of turnover and do it that way. But it is an international problem, but companies will always take advantage unless you can stop them.
Okay. We have a question from Lothian Borders and Central Area Committee of ICAS. How do you view the future of ICAS as a relatively small but influential body of worldwide CAs who continue to punch above its weight?
Well, I always remember Eddie Stamp, Professor Eddie Stamp, saying that the fact you have a Scottish accent gives you an advantage because people think you're intelligent, and even if you're not. And I think the Scots are associated with, engineers, doctors, miserable accountants. Mm. And that ethos is still there. You can feel it's there. I used to play the Scottish card quite a lot. Mm-hmm. And you can just see people sort of feel reassured with, you know, Scotty, the engineer in Star Trek and things like that. They like that sort of person. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean they like me, but they like the Scot. And mm-hmm. I think the Institute is always going to have a cachet. Mm-hmm. That if we were the British Institute, which makes a lot of sense in certain situations, it wouldn't have. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I think about the Institute is, being the size it is, it can be very nimble. Mm-hmm. And it's got a small group. The Scottish Mafia is quite well known. Mm-hmm. And you find out in that situation that it can move quickly and know who's to contact. Mm-hmm. Doesn't have to go through umpteen different committees to get things done.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now here's a question from social media. This is a question asked on Twitter by Secret Ledger. Do you think the modular approach to developing FRS 9 was a mistake?
Well, it was a necessity, basically. It wasn't the way we'd like to have done it. Let's go back to the crisis. The crisis was something that is still with us. It hasn't gone by any means. And if you look at what was going on then, I was a member of the Financial Stability Board, and it met shortly after Lehman's went down, and I don't think I've ever been in a meeting where you could almost smell the fear. And we were talking about central bankers, deputy finance ministers, securities regulators. There was a real feeling that the whole system could collapse. Mm-hmm. And you know, that was very much in the sense that what was happening. Now, one of the issues, of course, was IAS 39, and I've often said if you understand IAS 39, you haven't read it properly. It is complicated. It's the American standard, several American standards, all mushed into one. And you know, it wasn't one we particularly liked. We inherited it. We tried to change little bits of it, but we couldn't do very much. Total opposition from the French, who didn't want anything to do with fair values. Mm-hmm. So in this, I remember being interviewed by the BBC World Service, and the interviewer said, in this crisis, fingers are pointing at who is responsible, and they're pointing at you. Mm-hmm. And I said, they're right, they're right, it's me. You know, I made banks give up their risk management practices. I made them give loans to people who had no money, no income, no assets. I made the banks then take all these loans, chop them into bits, add them all together and other little bits, and send out these packages worldwide. I made the credit rating agencies give them AAA ratings. I made people buy them without doing any due diligence. It's all my fault. And there was a pause, and the interviewer said, for the benefit of overseas listeners, that was irony. And, and you know, we were faced with a situation at that time. It was probably the angriest I've ever been in my professional life, but we're trying to steer this thing through. What really got me was accounts were showing what the problem was. Because if you want to go back to the 19th century, you know, banks were financed 33% equity. Mm-hmm. By the end of that century, it was about 20%. By the end of the 20th century, it was down to 5%. And by the time of the crisis, 7 years later, it was down to 2%. Mm-hmm. And the banks' balance sheets had ballooned from something like the total of the major British banks' assets were about 75% of GDP, British GDP, at the turn of the century. By 2007, they were 200%. Mm-hmm. They were huge. Mm-hmm. And there you have equity of 2%. Well, you don't have to lose very much. Mm-hmm. So what were the regulators doing? Mm-hmm. And you know, you can blame it on accounting if you like, but there it was. They'd given up the balance sheet. Mm-hmm. It was leverage. And a lot of that, of course, was to really get returns for equity. But you're only 2% equity. So the other 98% stakeholders are almost being represented by a 2% group. And that 2% group, the average holding time was 3 months. Mm-hmm. So the quarter shareholders. Mm-hmm. And this is what the whole thing was predicated on. And then, of course, they tied management's incentive to shareholders. So, oh boy, let's leverage up. We get bigger incentives. And if you look at the American banks, about 1990, the CEOs of the top American banks, they were making something like $2.8 million in average dollars, which was 100 times the median US salaries. By the time of the crisis, they were making $26 million, which was 500 times the median. Mm-hmm. And it was all based on return on equities, mm-hmm. which blew the whole thing up. Mm-hmm. And here again, it's IFRS 39. And so what happened in this crisis, we had a situation where they were desperate mm-hmm. to do anything they could to save putting more money into the banks. At one stage in the crisis, one quarter of the world's GDP went into supporting the banking system worldwide. Mm-hmm. And anything they could do. And you know, I was summoned to the European Finance Ministers meeting, ECOFIN, and I remember the German finance minister saying, you know, our regional banks have bust. We're going to have to put in billions of euros. Now, you have got to change the accounting so it doesn't look as bad, so we don't have to put so much in. And you look at this guy, and he says, if you don't, you know, we will lose the election. Well, he was right. He lost the election. He didn't. And, you know, they anything to save the system. You know, if it means changing the accounting, showing false numbers, just go ahead and do it. Mm. And you had a situation where you had Berlusconi, Merkel and Sarkozy met with Barroso, and for half an hour they discussed IAS 39. Now, I'd love to hear what they said. One of the most incomprehensible political sessions I think I've ever heard. But they decided it's got to change. And in October, we suddenly found out that the Europeans were putting through, this was only a matter of weeks after Lehman, were putting through a law because they felt they were being disadvantaged compared to the United States, that you could change things from fair value to cost in rare circumstances in the States. Now, rare meant never, because we checked it. But they felt, well, we want to be able to avoid these losses by sticking to cost. Now, the Americans transferred at fair value, and they had disclosures. And the European Commission started to put through a law which just said all they could do was amend one of our standards by the standards accepted by Europe. They could take words out, they couldn't put words in. So where it says you're not allowed to reclassify, they just removed the not. So, okay, now you can reclassify, but there are no rules. And you know, our attitude initially was hell mend them, you know, just let them get on with it. And the SEC was absolutely in despair. They said, you've got to step in, because if you don't, you're going to get these companies made all these losses. Everybody knows they've made the losses because they reported the quarterly earnings. They'll add them all back. Nobody will know where the numbers came from. Nobody will trust any of the numbers. The market's already fragile, implode. Mm-hmm. You've got to step in and do something. Well, the law was going through in a week. So we spent a pretty hectic week with the SEC, with the major firms, trying to cobble together something which required disclosure. The fact that they said, well, the Americans could do this any time, so we said, OK, this is October, you could take it back to the fair value of July, but no further back, and you disclose what the profit would have been and the balance sheet effect until you get rid of that instrument. Mm. And the... in that situation, I think you had a problem in that we couldn't win. It didn't matter what we did, mm-hmm. Because we produced it, and you get someone like Deutsche Bank saying, oh, we've made a profit of X, it would have been a loss had we not done this. And so we were criticised for it, but at least people could work out what the number would have been. The Americans hammered us for the fact there was no due process. Well, you haven't got time to do due process when you've got a week and still writing the thing. And it was a case of, well, what was the choice? The other alternative was to do what the SEC asked us not to do, was to let the markets implode. Mm-hmm. And because they said it would spread to the US markets. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing could come down. So it was a pretty hectic time. Mm-hmm. So... they then asked us to do other things, Europe, and we refused. And I was... sort of thinking we're beating them back. And then poor old Bob Herz got beaten up in Congress, and he had to make a change that reduced the losses that were shown in the American P&L. So, of course, Europe wanted that as well. And I was summoned back to ECOFIN. And I remember before I'd even started, Lagarde's hand was up and Steinbrück's hand was up and the Polish finance minister's hand was up. And I launched IFRS 9 on them. And they were expecting to hear when was I going to do the American thing? And we told them, we're not going to do that. We're going to do something completely and utterly different. And Lagarde, of course, wasn't brief because we damn sure nobody had heard about it, and looked round at her advisors, who also went, I don't know. And that was it. Now, we then went to Bob, Bob Hurs and said, we ought to do this together, but we have to have a replacement for IS-39 by the end of the year, and this was March. We think we should deal with presentation and valuation, how we do it, what categories we value and how we do this. Bob agreed, his board wouldn't go with him. And that led to, they tried then to do it in total. They never ever got round to hedging. They went for a full fair value system, which if you want to commit suicide, that's a good way to do it. And that blew up. Now, we did tell them that had the British, had we introduced that in the UK, the British banking profits would have been 8 times more volatile. They would have shown £100 billion more profits between 2001 and 2006. In 2008, the losses would have reached £300 billion extra. It would have totaled in 2009, £400 billion, and the assets of British banks, net assets, were actually only £280 billion. So the entire British banking system would have been bust on a fair value basis. A few months later, they were fine. We never put the banking books to market. But that's the effect of a full fair value system would have had. So that's why it came in stages, was we had to do something for the crisis.
If we look at this, turn to auditors, Robert Coulter has asked a really interesting question about the way companies, particularly in the banking sector, were going into administration or liquidation, but just shortly after receiving a clean audit report. What are your thoughts on, could we improve that audit report? Is there something we could make it, way we could make it more meaningful? Or do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes, I think the present audit report is absolutely appalling. It's, I'm not responsible for this, management's responsible for that, and somewhere hidden in all that's the opinion. When I first started, you could tell at a glance if an audit report was qualified, because it was only about 4 or 5 lines long, and it would jump out. But I think things have gone way past that now. If you look at Northern Rock, it didn't have a going concern qualification. But it was predicated, its whole system was predicated on the fact it borrowed from the wholesale markets, 75% of its liabilities were due within 3 months, and it lent out 25 years. That's a business model that only works if there's an unlimited amount of funds coming from the wholesale markets. Now, that was in the accounts, you know, note 40-something or other. You know, the auditor should at least say why he's accepted a going concern assumption, because actually at that stage nobody would have expected the markets to freeze the way they did. Perfectly sensible assumption, but at least have it up front so people can say that's what it's based on. And the second thing that I feel that should be done is the fact that I don't think the auditor comes across as being sufficiently independent. In that recent Treasury, not Treasury, the parliamentary report, there seem to be a lot of people saying, well, what the company did wasn't inconsistent with the standard. But that's not what the standards say. It's true and fair. It's not, is it inconsistent with the standards? And I think we've got to do much more to bring out some of the issues. When you look at the American companies, there was one that received the Trouble Asset Relief Programme funds, and its audit report in 2008-2009 was word for word the same. And yet, the audit fee was $119 million in 2008. It was $193 million in 2009. Clearly a totally different audit. Now, what kept them awake at night? Why don't they tell us? What are the issues? What are the estimates? What are the policies? Where are the close calls? Where, well, it had gone that way or gone this way? Why aren't we told? And, you know, some people say, oh, they shouldn't say anything that management doesn't say. It should be the audit committee. You know, I disagree. I really believe the auditor should be absolutely on his own. There's several things I think should be done. I mean, I like the idea of mandatory tendering, but I also think the auditor should have a fair chance of getting back in again. And I would make the appointment, not for a year, but let's say you're going to re-tender between now and, you're going to re-tender and say 2022. Fine, the auditor's appointed in 2022. He can only be fired if he's incompetent. As agreed by the shareholders at a meeting, or if his fees go rocketing up, by the shareholders. I think there's a fair chance. If he's tough and he shows these things, and I think the shareholders should support him and do that. But I'd like to see them much more independent. The other thing I'd like to see is in the tender documents, no prices. You know, I don't know if you remember, but there was the famous one that appeared in the Accountancy Age about 20-odd years ago. Price Waterhouse's price was half whatever the other lowest bidder was. And so for many months, they were known as Half Price Waterhouse. And, but you know, that's outrageous.
Yeah.
And I would like the audit to be picked on quality and then ask the audit committee, OK, you felt that guy's fees were too high, tell us what the difference would be and why you chose the second best. Mm-hmm. Put the pressure on. I think there's a lot more we can do for the independence of the auditor. I think they have a pretty tough deal at the moment.
Could you mention True and Fair again? You've mentioned it a few times in this discussion. James Barber from ICAS, Director of Technical Policy, asked the question, do you ever envisage a time that the phrase true and fair will be removed from the legislative requirements of financial reporting?
Well, I hope not. You know, ultimately, that's what it's all about, because standards can't deal with everything.
Yeah.
So what's the objective against which you're trying to report? And sometimes, I remember when I was at KPMG, we threatened to qualify a major client who said he was obeying two standards, which he was, but the situation he was in, you could read them into the two standards, but the standards clearly were never designed to deal with his transaction. And it would have given them you know, a boost of profits about 10%, which would reverse the following year. Mm-hmm. And we just said, no, we don't care what the standard says. And you know, auditors have got to do that. That would be a huge mistake if that went out. Mm-hmm.
Chris Keane at Deloitte said, you know, as past president of ICAS, do you feel that there's a case for harmonising ICAS and ICAW, or do you think members are best served by the status quo?
Well, you know, the members are going to have to choose. You know, ICAS costs about another 100 quid more than ICAW. On the other hand, I personally believe that you get a very independent and different type of institute than you would get if you run out of Moorgate Place. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you know, for 100 quid people who don't want to do that, then I think there's going to be a problem. Mm-hmm. But I personally would not advocate a merger. Mm-hmm. I'm damn glad it didn't come up in my presidential year.
Just to show we're up to speed with social media, we have a question on Twitter by FCA blog. What are Sir David's thoughts on the George Bombas QC opinion that IFRS accounts may be illegal?
Well, I've never heard of the QC, and I have no idea what he's talking about, but I suspect he hasn't either. I think he's talking absolute rubbish.
Good. So that's him sorted. Robert Coulter, who asks so many questions, he also came up with this question about, with only four large international accountancy firms creating an effective oligopoly, do you consider this to be a sustainable position in the long term? Is there some way we could introduce or increase the number of major international accountancy firms, widen choice? Is there any possibility of that, do you feel?
Well, I think it will happen, possibly not in the way that people might expect. I think it's very difficult for, say, Grant Thornton or Binders to grow into one of the big four, or big five and six. I think it's going to come another way, and that is when you look at the growth out in the Far East, you're going to see the Chinese companies are getting bigger and bigger. They're expanding. At the moment, they're audited mainly by Chinese companies. But as they start taking over others, I think the Western markets are a bit wary of the Chinese profession. Mm-hmm. The Chinese Ministry of Finance is wary of it. Mm-hmm. It thinks they're young. Most of them were shot during the Cultural Revolution, so it's a completely new profession. A lot of the sort of ethics and things are there in name, but are they there in practice? Mm-hmm. And the Ministry of Finance is genuinely concerned about things like that. Mm-hmm. I think when it came to the end, they may well look to Binders and to Grant Thornton to be, if you like, the Anglo-Saxon end mm-hmm. of a Chinese major auditing firm. Mm-hmm. And that might be the five and six comes out of the merger of those with some Asian firm.
Yeah.
And probably out of China.
Yeah.
Not out of Japan, I don't think.
Interesting idea. Now, we've got maybe room for another couple of questions, and in a light-hearted vein, Ken Pratt asked the question, and he says, when Sir David addresses an audience, we are not only treated to frank and informative analysis of a subject, but also to a liberal sprinkling of jokes. Has there ever been an occasion somewhere around the world when one of these has gone up like a lead balloon?
Yes. don't tell jokes in Asia. The Japanese do not understand my sense of humour, that's for sure. Mm. I remember at a dinner, I was giving a speech and I gave this joke. I was asked to repeat the punchline 5 times. I gave up at that stage. The board was helpless. They loved it. And But when you're dealing with translations, don't even try. I don't try in China. I don't try in Japan. If you go to one of the former colonies, Hong Kong, Singapore, they get it. Mm-hmm. You know, they've got the British sense of humour, but not the others. No. Mm-hmm. It bombed.
A final question from Lothian Borders Central Area Committee. After a long and highly distinguished career in accountancy, what part did you enjoy most and what do you want to be remembered for?
Well, it's strange, really, because when we went to the IASB, we had a different idea of what might happen. We thought we were there as a think tank. Mm. So the idea would be this body would produce standards that if, say, the Aussies wanted to replace whatever standard it was, it would take the one that we'd written and the Brits would take maybe a different one and so on. Europe changed all that. Mm-hmm. The minute they said that the listed companies in Europe were going to IFRS, that made us Europe's standard setter. And then when the others started coming in, that made the world standard setter. Mm-hmm. So the whole objective changed from trying to write, if you like, quotes, the perfect standard. We had to take the suite of standards that we inherited and improve them, which took 4 or 5 years. It wasn't a lot of fun. It was just pulling paragraphs out and sticking new ones in. I think it's disappointing in a way we didn't get the Americans over the line, which we probably would have done had it been not for the crisis. I think they'll still come in. As Winston Churchill says, the Americans always do the right thing, but only after they've tried everything else first. And the sort of thing that's going to happen, I think, you're already seeing in Japan, their multinationals are voluntarily going to IFRS. Now, they reckon 20% of the Japanese capitalisation within a couple of years will be on IFRS, domestic. Mm-hmm. That's going to put huge pressure to get the rest in because they're the smaller companies. And Japanese standards are pretty close anyway to IFRS. China's 95% there. So if they both went word for word to IFRS, India, which is always thinks itself a special case, which it isn't, would almost certainly come in. That leaves the US in lovely isolation. Mm-hmm. And I think the pressure on them then will be massive. And a lot of their multinationals would go tomorrow. Ford would go, General Motors would go. Mm-hmm. Yeah, anyone that deals with other companies being compared to them on an IFRS basis will go. So if the Americans gave an option, there'd be a lot of their companies go as well. Mm-hmm. So I can see it happening. It's just delayed from where it would have been. That was frustrating. But I think probably some of the most satisfying moments were probably at the ASB, where we saw all these things that were going on in the City of London and we got after them and stamped them out. Mm. And that was because the profession actually bonded. You know, it was a case of the firms wanted it removed, the press wanted it removed, investors wanted these things removed, and the tide was there. Mm. And in a way, you're lucky in a way. You go to a job at the time, people are so fed up with what's there, there's a lot of support. The same with the ISB, and the globalisation time had come, and you're lucky if you're there at the right time. If you're not, then it's much, much harder. So I think those were the things that I felt most satisfied by.
Well, it's been splendid, David. It's been just great seeing you again and chatting to you. All these people listening to us. We now turn to Peter Williams, who's going to give a vote of thanks on behalf of ICAS.
Yeah, please. So David, thank you very much. It's been a fascinating discussion and evening. First of all, I'd like to actually thank the audience for coming and attending, because clearly without you guys, these things just don't are just not worth putting on. We need attendance. The committee runs a series of events during the year. The next one is going to be on the 6th of September, and keeping it topical, it's going to be about sustainability of football. So I encourage you all to come along and attend that. I'd like to thank the university for supporting us and providing the facility tonight, putting on this event. The cooperation between the business school and the local committee has been established over the last few years with Rob Ray, who unfortunately is not here tonight, and Professor Lapsley are doing a great job of putting a lot of events on for us. And thanks to Irwin for chairing the evening and keeping Sir David on his toes with these questions. But the main thanks to you, Sir David. I think it's been a really fascinating evening, and thank you for all your comments about your career and your thoughts about the important aspects of accounting. So thank you for this evening, but also I think it behoves us to thank you for all your work of the last year as President of the Institute. You've done a sterling job of supporting us and promoting the interests of the Institute. So if you